say who he is and let him ramble off his own bio, because, man, I got a bio today from my producer. It was so long. I'm sitting there looking at it. I'm like, oh, my God. I can't do this. I'll be here for a half hour explaining this. David.
Hello, Lou.
How are you doing?
I'm all right. As all right as you can be at 3:15 in the morning.
Well, it's a pleasure to meet you, sir.
Uh-huh.
Let everybody know exactly who you are. I was gonna start off with a bio, but you know what? I have one that's about 6 pages long.
Right. That probably covers about a day then.
Exactly.
Right.
So,
you know, day of my life.
Who is David Icke?
Well, it doesn't exist really. It's just a mythical personality like all of us. Before we get into deep things like that, in theory, I am someone who was born in Leicester, England, in 1952, and became a professional soccer player. I finished at 21 with rheumatoid arthritis. Became a journalist. Eventually started working for the BBC as a network news presenter and then sports presenter. Became involved in green politics, which was extremely important for me from the perspective I am now, because it allowed me to see what an irrelevance politics is and what a game it is. And then I started realizing towards the end of the 80s, particularly the early 90s, that the world was definitely not like we thought it was. I didn't realize at the time that it was absolutely nothing like we thought it was, but enough for me to start following a trail of information that the world was not controlled by forces that appeared to control it on the television news. And over the last 13 years, I've traveled to more than 40 countries researching this, and the trickle has become a tidal wave. And I've written something like 10 books, and my last five total some 1.5 million words about how the world's controlled by a network of interconnected secret societies, which are in effect one secret society, which has an agenda to create a global fascist state. They, of course, if there's a few of you and you want to control the many, you have to centralize decision making. And what has been now picked up by people on the left in politics and dubbed globalization, the centralization of power in business, in banking, in politics, in all areas of our lives, in the military, is actually simply this agenda for the global fascist state unfolding before our eyes. And what's happening now in Iraq and what happened with September the 11th are all connected to this network and its agenda for centralized global control, and in effect the centralized global big brother state, as described by George Orwell in his book 1984.
Is this something like the Illuminati? Would this be one of these organizations?
Yeah, I mean, the Illuminati is the name they give themselves. Basically, it's a network that goes back a long time,
mm-hmm.
that has been unfolding through the decades and the centuries, a policy of centralization of power. Like I say,
David, real quick,
if you want to control the many, you have to centralize decision making. The more points of decision making there are, the less control you're going to have over them.
Right.
Symbolically, it's like if you're on a stage and you're one of those guys that, you know, keeps plates spinning on sticks. If you've got plates all over the stage, eventually they're going to start crashing. What you want symbolically is one big plate and one big stick, because you stand there and keep that going all day. And so what they want is a world government, world central bank, world army, world currency.
Now, when you said earlier, a
microchip population. Once they've got that centralized dictatorship in place, they can dictate the policy to the world.
Right. Now, what you said earlier about it going back a long ways, are we talking about something that goes back even further than America's existence and fades over maybe into Europe and
the
whole continent over there?
You can go back. I go back in my books and others have done the same. It goes back at least to ancient Babylon. It goes before then, but that's a real point where you can pick it up. And so much of the symbolism that these people use and put in our faces, it goes back to ancient times like that, to Babylon. And when they moved their headquarters eventually from Babylon, they moved it to Rome. And that's when we had the Roman Empire. They then moved on into Europe and particularly centralized the operation in places like London, particularly London, and that's when we had the British Empire. And what I've realized in my research over the years is that these empires were actually empires of the Illuminati that were based in these places, not actually the empires of the places themselves. Just talking of symbolism, something very relevant to America, in ancient Babylon they had a trinity in their kind of rituals and religion, which was the trinity of Nimrod, who they symbolized as a fish, Tammuz, Ninus, the sun, and they said the father and son were one, and that Tammuz, Ninus died in effect to save humanity, the sins of humanity, and the third point of the trinity was called Queen Semiramis. Now, when you see how the Babylonians symbolized Queen Semiramis in coins and what have you, it is an absolute mirror of the Statue of Liberty. And who gave the Statue of Liberty to New York? French Freemasons from Paris, who understood what the symbolism really was. Mm-hmm. And the classic symbol of the Illuminati is the lighted torch or the flame, the illuminated ones, illuminated into knowledge the rest of the population don't get. So you have an image of Queen Semiramis holding the lighted torch of the Illuminati, and Americans are told that that symbolizes the fact that it's the land of the free. What it actually symbolizes is the fact it's not the home of the brave, but more the home of the slave, like every other country, including my own. And if you go to Paris, on an island in the River Seine, is a mirror, again, of the Statue of Liberty. You would think it was the same one. Why? Because so-called goddess of the French Republic, in their symbolism, is again a classic expression of Queen Semiramis, because the same people who moved up through Paris, as I was talking about, took that symbolism, and so it's now the symbol, the goddess symbol of the French Republic, and it's Queen Semiramis from Babylon. So this goes back a long time, and what they've been doing, as we pass through the centuries, is constantly centralizing power. If you look at in Europe now, we have a massive stepping stone to the world government with the European Union, where bureaucrats in Brussels now dictate the laws to the whole of Europe. I'll tell you how strong that is and fundamental that is. We had a group of market traders. They're just ordinary guys. Not that there is such a thing as an ordinary guy, but you know what I mean, in a market, and they were just selling their fruit and vegetables. And what they were doing is they were giving their customers the choice, hey, what happened to that, to buy the fruit and vegetables either in the metric system of the European Union or in the British system of pounds and ounces. Fair enough. How do you want them? Pounds and ounces or what? And what happened? These guys got prosecuted for selling in pounds and ounces, which is the British system. So what happened is that people got behind them who had money, and they appealed, and they went to the highest court in Britain. We call it the High Court, but it's basically your Supreme Court. And the judges had to rule that the prosecution had to stand because laws made in the European Union were now the ones that had to stand if they were at odds with laws made in a country of Europe. So whatever laws are passed in Westminster in the British Parliament now, or any other country of the European Union, if those laws are at odds with laws decided by bureaucrats in Brussels, then the bureaucrat laws supersede the ones decided in the British Parliament or the other parliaments. So what you've got now is centralization of power. Now a few are dictating the laws and the policies for the whole of Europe. It's just one step from there to the world level, and that's what we're seeing unfold before our eyes now.
That's a lot of interesting information. I know you have a lot of different views on a lot of different things that a lot of people don't know.
Right.
How does one find all of this, like, type of hidden government, type of conspiracy, type of hidden knowledge, societies and things? How do you stumble upon that? I mean, how did you do that?
Well, first of all, some very enlightened people have been writing about this stuff for a long time. It's been right out on the fringes and beyond of society. So some of it has been documented through the years. But what happens? It's cumulative. First of all, you pick up a strand of information, and it means a certain amount. But then as you go through, and like I say, I've been to more than 40 countries. I mean, I do this, you know, full time every day. And you pick up another strand somewhere else, and that will fit to this other strand. And now the other strand, the significance of it gets even greater. And basically what you're doing is you're picking up pieces of information. You're doing it through research. You're doing it through reading published documents, which mean nothing unless you put one piece with another. And then suddenly a published document that seems innocuous, it suddenly takes on a very different light. And what happens is as you travel, you meet people who have experienced things or know things, who have been on the inside, who want to help pass it on because they've realized what's going on, but they have no either means to do it, to get it into the public domain, or they're frightened of putting their name to it and doing it themselves. And what you do is you eventually, it's like pieces in a jigsaw puzzle. And the more pieces you get, the more you put it together, the clearer the picture becomes. And what I found was the real moment when not just pennies dropped, but whole banking systems dropped in my mind, was when I realized the structure through which this is done, because it was clearly going to be a simple one, because complexity would have been impossible to hold together. And basically, when I realized the structure in which they operate and how they do it, it was like getting all those pieces, the straight line pieces in a puzzle that frame the picture, in place. And once I got that in place, putting the other pieces together got much easier, because I realized how it worked.
Hmm. That's wild. It really is. I don't even know where to start with this. where do you want to start?
Well, what I could do, Lou, if you like, for people who are new to this, is just explain that this very system of how it works. It's a structure they put in place, which means that the very few can control the many without the many having any idea it's going on.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at any organization today, well, let me say first what the structure basically is. It's like Russian dolls. If you think of Russian dolls, where you've got one doll inside a bigger doll inside a bigger doll, and eventually there's the biggest doll that encompasses all the others. What they've done is create a system of small pyramids encompassed by bigger pyramids encompassed by bigger pyramids until you have a pyramid that encompasses all the others, the global pyramid, as I call it. And it works like this. If you look at any organization today, a government, a university, a business, they're all structured as pyramids, compartmentalized pyramids, as they say in the secret services and stuff. The top of the pyramid, the capstone, you've got a tiny few people who know what that organization is really about, what its agenda is, where it's really heading, and why. As you come down from that pyramid peak and those tiny few people, you meet more and more and more people in the organization. But as you go down, they know less and less and less of what the organization's really about. They only know their part. It can be described in secret service parlance as the need to know. They only know what they need to know to make their contribution. These people in a bank or in a multinational company or in a government, they're not trying to manipulate anybody. They're not trying to create a world centralized fascist state. They just want to go to work, earn their money, and look after their family and live their life. But because of this compartmentalization, they don't know that they're apparently, on the surface, individually innocent contribution to that organization. They don't know how that connects with other people throughout that bank or throughout that banking system or throughout that government who are in the same position. The only people that know how those apparently innocent contributions fit together to create anything but an innocent pattern are the tiny few at the top who know how the whole pyramid fits together. And so you'll get a bank. If you hand your check to a guy in the local bank, he hasn't got a clue what the bank manager behind him is deciding and is discussing. That bank manager doesn't know what's being discussed at the state level of that bank. They don't know what's being discussed at the national level of that bank. They don't know what's happening at the international level of that bank. And in every organization, there's a cabal at the top that is even beyond the international level that is really controlling this. Now, that bank then goes into the next pyramid and the next pyramid, and eventually you have a pyramid that encompasses the entire global banking system. And when you get to the top of that, it's run by a handful of people. When you do the same with transnational corporations, you find that there is, in effect, basically one transnational corporation. When you get high enough in this this pyramid within pyramid system, there's a journalist worth the name called John Pilger, an Australian who's written some very good stuff about the nature of the exploitation of people through what is called globalization. But he did a documentary on British television maybe a couple of years ago now, in which he said that a quarter of the world's economic activity is now down to 200 corporations. Now, that's staggering enough, but if you go to the next level of what I'm talking about, you find that those 200 corporations are, in effect, one corporation. They do it by interlocking directorships. So one person will be a director of this organization, but he'll also be a director of this one and a director of that one. And they also do it by putting phony people onto boards who are not actually the ones in power. They are representing someone that people don't know who they're representing. And in this way, they control all these apparently unconnected organizations. And this system means that a tiny few can use the general population to advance an agenda that those people have no idea actually exists. And what is happening in the world compared with what we're told is happening is so fantastically different. There's such a chasm between them that even when the truth comes out, it's so fantastic to most people that they dismiss it and say, oh, no, that's too far-fetched, mate. I mean, you know, if you said to people, do you know that there's tremendous connections between the Bush family and the Bin Laden family? People say, no, he's fighting Bin Laden. No, that's the movie, darling. Actually, what's happening is they're all connected behind the scenes. And it's this connection that you start to see that what we're looking at is literally a movement. I mean, I call CNN, Lou, I call CNN the movie channel, because that's what it's giving us. It's giving us a version of events that is not what is happening. It is what those in authority want us to think is happening, because that obscures what's really happening.
Well, what about the rest of the news agencies out there? I think
Lou, like this. And I was a journalist for a long time.
Right.
Again, we're talking pyramids here.
Sure.
In terms of the media. Journalists, most journalists covering the war in Iraq, etc., they're not trying to manipulate anybody. But where do they get their information from? I mean, let's look at September the 11th. I've just published a book, Alice in Wonderland, The World Trade Center Disaster, which is 500 pages that demolishes the official story, which a three-year-old could actually do. But where is the official story that is now accepted by, you know, literally billions of people on planet Earth? Where has it come from? It's come from official statements from people like the FBI, who you wouldn't trust to tell you the time if you look at its history, and even their own agents have come out in relation to September the 11th and talked about the cover-up of information and the blocks on investigations into the Bin Laden family and terrorist networks in America. It's come from the Pentagon. I mean, would anyone buy a new car, let alone a used one, from Donald Rumsfeld? It's come from the CIA. It's come from the White House. Oh, my goodness me, George Bush. Would he tell a lie? Crikey. Wouldn't you know George Bush is lying? Ah, his lips are moving. That's got it, yes. Now, these are the sources, Lou, which the whole official story of September the 11th has come from. Now, if we had real journalism, what would happen is when the official story was given, the journalists would investigate it. You're journalists, you know. Have a look in the dictionary for the definition of journalist. Mm-hmm. And they would find the official story wanting, and they would communicate that to the public. What happens instead is that journalists have become a public relations office for the official version of life. So what journalists do is take the official version, and then they pass it on, virtually unquestioned and undiluted, to the public. They're nothing more than couriers of information from the official sources. And so the public get this information from the official sources. It becomes their reality. And what journalists ought to be doing is investigating the official version, and then they might realize that actually that they've been sold a lie all these years. That doesn't happen. And because of that, the authorities have official or free rein to indoctrinate the public with their unquestioned version of reality. That's what's happening every day.
Now, as far as these different companies, these 200 companies that supposedly, what, control the world? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Well, no, it's not. They're just a strand. I mean, in the end, if you go high enough up this global pyramid, which encompasses all the others, which controls the banking system, the transnational corporations, the major governments, etc., you're actually looking at a very small number of people at the peak of the peak of the peak. The transnational corporations are not, and this I would suggest is where those who are trying to highlight and expose this globalization have actually got so far up the pyramid, but they need to go further, because it's not, globalization is not about big bad transnational companies wanting more and more power and more money. The transnational corporations are not it. They are a means through which it can advance its agenda for global centralization of power in all areas of our lives. They are a vehicle. They're not it. The it gets pretty small when you get to the top of the pyramid. And because of this pyramid within pyramid system of compartmentalization, it is possible for a few to dictate a policy through all areas of society, because these different areas of society don't realize at the lower levels where it unfolds that actually they are connected to another area of society. I mean, the transnational corporations are controlled by the same people that control the banks, same people that control the oil cartel, same people that control the pharmaceutical cartel. But at the level of people playing that out, who work for the pharmaceuticals every day, who work for the oil companies and stuff, they don't know that. And because of this pyramid compartmentalization, it's possible for this to happen.
Hmm. What's the deal with these oil companies? I mean, you know, we have so many different kinds of energy out there that we could actually integrate, I guess, for the most part, halfway decently into the economy. Why are we staying with oil? Just too much greed and big bucks in this, or what?
Well, that's one level of it. Let me give you a story that happened to me about 1990. Well, it wasn't about. It was 1997. I was in America, and I was approached by someone to see if I would meet a guy who was a scientist working for the CIA, because this guy was horrified by what was going on, and he wanted to try to get some of this information out. I met him, and he told me that he joined the CIA as a scientist. He's an expert in the area of magnetics, because he thought he was serving his country. Again, here we go, compartmentalization. When people say, it's the CIA, well, hold on a minute. The CIA is a lot of people in a lot of places. The CIA is a compartmentalized pyramid. Many, many people working for the CIA genuinely think they're serving their country. They don't realize that a force is controlling the CIA and using them as a pawn. So he joined the CIA thinking he was serving his country. And what happened is he found out very quickly, he told me, that actually this agenda that I'm talking about tonight actually existed. And my goodness me, he was being used to advance it. And so he rebelled against it and refused to work for them. And what happened is that he said he left home one day, and then he has missing time. He remembers nothing until waking up on a medical-type bench in a room. And as he got his faculties back, he realized that there was something stuck to his chest. And as he was telling me this story, he was undoing his shirt, and what I saw on his chest was like a see-through shampoo sachet, like a plastic see-through sachet, and in that was an orangey golden liquid, and they call these apparently in the CIA patches. And he was telling me that not just him, but large numbers of scientists and other people who have the ability to make a contribution to this agenda but do not wish to, are patched. And what he told me was that his body was manipulated to need the drug inside this patch to survive. And if it's not replaced, then he starts to die. And in other words, don't play the game, and we don't replace the patch. Now, this guy has got a family, I met his children. I mean, he doesn't want to die, so he went back and started working for them again. Now, these patches have to be replaced every 72 hours. That's the level of control they have over them. Now, the reason I tell you this story in relation to your question is this. He told me that the technology to give us all the warmth and power we need without any utility bills has been known for decades and decades and decades, called free energy technology. It accesses the natural vibrational energy fields in the ether around us and turns it into usable warmth and power. And once you've got the kit, the technology, it runs itself. You don't have to pay a utility company. You just does it without, you know, paying any more money out. He also said that the technology to create abundant growth in deserts without water has also been known for a long time. In fact, he was telling me he played a part in developing it. What they do is they resonate the natural energy fields of the plants, and he said that at its optimum, these plants grow like a time-lapse photograph. He also told me that the cure for cancer has been known for a long time. Now, let's come to the question, why is this stuff not in the public arena? Well, it's a very simple equation. If this stuff was made available to everyone, suddenly we would have more and more abundance. And the equation is abundance equals choice equals freedom. That is not what the Illuminati want. They want another equation, which is scarcity equals dependency equals control. So much that would free the world of the so-called impossible problems like world hunger and all that stuff. That would remove that, because as he pointed out, there is no need for people to be hungry. The technology exists for that not to happen. But if it did, people would be given abundance of freedom, and that's not the idea. So we have manufactured scarcity, and anything that would give us an opportunity to remove that scarcity and remove that dependency is suppressed and not allowed into the public domain. I don't know whether you know that anyone that wants to apply for a patent for any new technology, those patents have to be checked by the military to see if they have, quote, possible military uses. And if the military, it's very arbitrary, I mean, there's no discussion. If the military decide, this could be used for military purposes, then they not only don't give the people, the discoverer, the developer, the inventor, a patent, they confiscate the technology. They confiscate all the papers relating to technology, and it is illegal from that point for the inventor to in any way develop, sell that technology. And this is a massive way of keeping these technologies, alternative technologies to the oil and all the other stuff, out of the public arena. It's a dam to ensure that only that which they want in the public domain, in everyday use, is there.
Why would they do this? I mean, this is kind of bizarre, because you know, you think that we as a society are trying to, you know, go as far and advance as far as we possibly can, but it sounds like, and a lot of this sounds, you know, pretty correct, that for some reason somebody is just trying to take control of us and to push us back. For what?
Well, it's not so much pushing us back as pushing us in. For instance, where technology suits the agenda, they will allow it into the public domain. For instance, what massively suits the agenda, what is their jewel in the crown, if you like, is microchips, microchip people. I've been writing about this for like 13 years, and when I first started writing about it, you know, people found it very funny. Well, microchip people, you're mad. And now, of course, particularly since 9/11, these microchips are being introduced. Thousands of people in America are being microchipped, and the this scientist with a patch actually said to me in our discussion, if people say no to one thing, tell them say no to the microchip. Because what he was saying was that even those that are starting to wake up to this are seeing the microchip as a form of electronic tagging so the computer knows where everyone is. And he said, yeah, well, that's one level of it, but it's much bigger than that. He said it's not so much the messages going from the chip to the computer in terms of location that we should be looking at. Mm-hmm. It's the messages coming from the computer to the chip. And what he was telling me, this is 1997, is that microchips outside the public arena already existed, and what was only left was to manipulate the public to accept them. These chips are designed to take messages from the computer. And these messages can either isolate one chip in one person, in other words, target one person, or they can be delivered en masse. And he said these have the ability to manipulate people's emotions, to make them aggressive, to make them docile, to stop them thinking, to make them sexually active or sexually suppressed, all these different levels of human emotion and mental activity. He said these chips have the potential to manipulate. He said once people get a chip inside them, you know, you're in serious trouble here in terms of control of your own thinking and emotional processes.
That's a big thing.
And some years ago, I mean, if you think, oh, that's fantastic, that's not possible. Well, let me give you this story. A few years ago, I had satellite television in Britain. And what they do is they send you a card, and you put it in some machine under the television, and whatever that card is programmed to accept, in other words, what you've paid for, they're the channels that you can get. Now, one night, I decided that, there was a program coming up the following week, or maybe 2 weeks, and I wanted to see it. It was on a channel I didn't have, so I thought, I've got to take that channel if I'm going to see that program. So I called the people, the television company, and they were based in Scotland, which is about as far in Britain from me as you can get. And I said, look, I want to take this other channel. Now, what I thought in those days was what they'd do is I'd give them a credit card number. What they would do then is send me a new card, and I'd put it in the machine, and I'd get the channel. No, I'm on the phone like I am to you, and the guy said to me, all right, he said, look at your screen and tell me what's happening. And I looked at the screen, and this channel came up. And I said, how did you do that? He said, I've just reprogrammed the card in your machine. And he's done it from Scotland while I'm watching the screen.
Right.
Now, this is the very foundation of what this CIA scientist was telling me that can happen once with these microchips. And 911, of course, like I say, has led to many, many people starting to be microchipped. It's happening in here in Britain as well. We've got this monumental idiot at Reading University, a professor, who is being used amid great publicity as the front man to sell this microchipped people technology idea to people. Now, what we're looking at in terms of the reason that so much has changed since September the 11th in terms of not just the microchipping program advancing more than ever before, but also in terms of the Patriot Act and taking away basic freedoms of privacy and the war on terrorism, is a technique that I came across many, many years ago when I was researching how these guys operate. And it's a technique that I've dubbed problem reaction solution. It was known when I first came across it as the Hegelian dialectic, which I thought, well, I think we can simplify that a little bit. So I call it problem reaction solution, and it's devastating. And September the 11th is the most classic example of it I've ever seen. What happens is you want to change society in a way that you know that if you stand on a podium at the White House or Downing Street and announce that this is what you're going to do, you're going to get tremendous reaction, anti-reaction from the public. You're going to stand there and say, well, what we've decided is we're going to have more and more surveillance. We're going to have more and more ability of the authorities to follow you, movements on the Internet, to demand your emails, to tap your phones and all this stuff. And also, by the way, we're going to go and bomb any country we choose to. Okay, that's it. Okay, thank you very much. Good night. You would get tremendous reaction against that. So quite simply, you don't do it like that. You play problem, reaction, solution. And it works like this, and it works the same every time. Because if it works, why change it? Stage one, you covertly create a problem. It could be a terrorist event. It could be a war. It could be a government collapse. It could be a run on the stock market. You, however, make sure that you who are really behind it never get collared for it, never get identified for it. And one way of preventing that is to, as soon as the problem has occurred, you tell the public what or who is the villain behind it, so that they're focusing on that person rather than looking around with an open mind, hey, what's behind this? So first of all, you create the problem. You name the person or reason why the problem has unfolded. And then we come back to what I said earlier. Problem, reaction, solution would fall down at this stage if we had real journalism who investigated the official version of events. They do not. Therefore, what happens at stage two is the authorities then tell the media who's responsible for the problem and their version that they want the people to believe about it, whether it's a terrorist bomb or whatever. The media then overwhelmingly, the mainstream, pass that version of events to the public unquestioned and undiluted. And that's the only version the public hear. So what do the public do? Understandably, they believe it in vast numbers. And what they're looking at stage two in this technique, looking for, is the public in reaction to the problem to say, something must be done, this can't go on, what are they going to do about it? And at that point, those who have covertly created the problem glean that public reaction, do something, then openly, through changes in legislation and changes in society, offer the solutions to the problems they have themselves created. Immediately after 9-1-1, which when I saw it, because of the research I've done over the years, it was just absolutely, like I say, a classic example of this technique. I went on a radio station, a mainstream drive-time station in Los Angeles, with a couple of guys who apparently had the brain cell activity to remember to breathe every few seconds, but I was, you know, doubtful myself. And what happened was I was saying a few days after 9-1-1, actually, you know, this has not been orchestrated by some guy in a cave in Afghanistan. This has been orchestrated within the borders of the United States by the force that actually controls the government. Not the government, because, you know, the government's a big thing, but the force that controls it, so, and controls the Bush family and all that stuff. And they said, what are you on, mate? And what I said to them is, look, okay, I tell you what, let me come back in a month, and if ABC has not happened, in other words, changes in legislation to take away more basic freedoms, more privacy, and centralization of power, I'll hold my hand up and say I was wrong. All right, mate, we'll have you on back in a month, they said. Well, they never called, because what happened in that month is the Patriot Bill went through. Now we have the Patriot Bill 2, which is incredibly fascist in taking away absolutely basic freedoms, allowing secret arrests and all this stuff. And we have the war on terrorism. And also, of course, we have Homeland Security. And in the what George Orwell called newspeak, in other words, calling something the opposite of what it really was to kid people that it wasn't what it really is, Homeland Security is a wonderful thing, because what I found is if you replace the word security with the word control throughout society, where people talk about so-and-so security,
right,
you'll find the real reason for those organizations. That's not Homeland Security, it's Homeland Control.
Sure.
It's the movement towards a militarized state in America. And 9-1-1 has been a absolute imperative in the agenda that has unfolded since. Without 9-1-1, the Patriot Bill and these basic freedoms would not have been taken away. Without 9-1-1, there would not have been the invasion of Afghanistan, for which the oil story needs to be told about one level of what that was about. And there would not be the war on terrorism. There would not be all the things that have unfolded since. That was problem, reaction, solution. And they're playing it on us all the time. It's massively effective, and unless you know the game, when you do, it's not effective anymore, which is why communicating information about this is so important.
Well, I got about 5 minutes left before we got to go into a break.
Right.
I want you to, in a nutshell, because when we come back, we're going to take some calls, and I also want to discuss your book, Alice in Wonderland and the World Trade Center Disaster, Why the Official Story of 9/11 is a Monumental Lie.
Right.
Very interesting stuff. But in a nutshell, before we got to take this break, what can you tell people about why 9/11 was such a monumental lie for this country?
Well, my book's 500 pages, and after the break, I can go into some detail of some of the background, if you like.
Oh, yeah.
And how the official story does not add up. But let me give you a version of this. You see, they realize, they know, that people, when they watch the media, do not pick up detail. They pick up an image. So what they're doing is they're playing and they are manipulating people's image of something because they know they won't retain the detail. And there's no greater example of that with relation of 911 than the hijacker's passport. I mean, just after September the 11th, the FBI, when they were selling us this official story, the FBI called a news conference in New York and said they'd found a passport from one of the hijackers who was in one of the planes that hit the World Trade Center. Now, Lou, I'm not a physics major, right? But I saw those fireballs, and then I look at a paper passport. I see the fact that something like two-thirds of the bodies of the people apparently were never found. And yet, within no time after this event, a few streets away from Ground Zero, someone, that someone never been identified, found this passport. I mean, excuse me, I sat at that time and I watched a BBC newsreader tell me, without laughing and without questioning, that this passport had been found. Now, what was that was doing? Was feeding the image. Yes, see, it is right. It was them Islams. Look, they found one of the passports.
Right.
And then what actually happened is, as I was researching Alice in Wonderland, I went back to New York Police. And I said to them, could you just tell me, they put me on to the guy who could answer my question, could you tell me which of the hijackers you named the passport belongs to? Can't give you that information. Why? Well, there's an ongoing investigation. I said, well, you've named 19 people. You said one of the passports of one of them has been found. How would it affect an ongoing investigation by just telling me which one it belonged to? I don't know how it would affect the ongoing investigation, but there's an ongoing investigation. We can't give that information. What then happened is that the anniversary of September the 11th, a year later, there was a documentary on British television in which someone asked about this passport. They asked the FBI about it. And the FBI said, this is a year after they called a news conference to announce they'd found it. The FBI said the hijacker's passport is a, quote, rumor that might be true. It's a nonsense. But because people don't remember a statement in September 2001 and they put it together with a statement in October and a statement in May, etc., they get away with it because what they were doing was working the image by saying they'd found this passport and then they just forget about it. And then when people go back and say, hold on, where is it? Suddenly you realize it doesn't exist. But it doesn't matter to them because people do not put these things together. It just passes people by. This is how they get away with it. There was no... So why lie and say they'd found a passport that didn't exist? Because it was part of the manipulation to sell the official story. And I, you know, after the break, I could talk in detail about some of the things that went on.
Well, we definitely want to do that. This is very, very interesting stuff here, David. It really is. And I am actually really impressed, man, at 3 o'clock in the morning, you're this wired to do this.
Oh. Yeah, I think it's called very strong coffee, Lou. I think that's what they call it. I'm having it intravenously at the moment.
Oh yeah, how's the coffee over there considered in relationship to the United States?
Well, you see, you can't make tea and we can't make coffee, right? You know, just like we're divided by the same language. You're good on coffee. We're good on tea. So when I come to America, I drink coffee.
All right, we're going to take a short break now. We're speaking tonight with David Icke, and we're going to be speaking about his latest book, Alice in Wonderland and the World Trade Center Disaster. You there?
Hello.
All right. Usually I have a delay when I call overseas. I guess we're not having too much of a delay tonight.
No, it's not bad at all.
This is pretty cool. Pretty good connection. All right, let's David, let's take some calls, and then we're going to go into your latest book, Alice in Wonderland and the World Trade Center Disaster, Why the Official Story of 9/11 is a Monumental Lie. You're on the Lou Gentile Show. Who am I speaking with? Hello. Good evening.
Are you speaking with me?
I'm speaking with you.
Oh, I'm honored. Mr. Icke, thank you so much.
Okay, mate.
I have, over the last, say, 20 years, been slowly drawn back into the old karmic conflict of which you have written so well. And of late have found myself sufficiently enthused to participate. But my question tonight, I find myself asking you, what's your best advice for personal safety strategies? As one enters the field of, metaphorically speaking, of battle, you expose yourself. And these days, that's hard not to do. How do you recommend staying alive?
Well,
so to speak.
Well, everything is Alice in Wonderland. What is, isn't. What isn't, is. In every area that I've ever researched, and I don't actually give advice in the sense of telling people what I think they should do, because I think, you know, from morning till night, from cradle to grave, we're being told others what we should do, and real power is deciding for ourselves what we think we should do. But I just say a few things about the question, which is how do we stay safe? I would say quite simply to not believe that you're in any danger.
Thank you.
We create our own reality. In fact, I'm just working on a book now, which is absolutely all about this, and it's been a revelation to me putting this together, and it is fundamental, bottom line, to understanding so much about what we call the paranormal, for instance, but also to understand how we are manipulated, and it is to realize that this 3D five sense world is an illusion. It only exists in our minds, and I've come across some things that I had no idea about before. People say, I saw it with my own eyes. Do you know, you don't actually see with your eyes. Of course you do. Everyone knows. No. You see with your brain. As what happens is information comes in through the eyes, and we don't actually see it until it hits what's called the visual cortex in the brain. Now, what scientists' experiments and trials have done is show that up to and sometimes more than 50% of what comes in through the eyes does not actually make it to the visual cortex where we actually see, because the information passes through the other parts of the brain, the temporal lobes, and the brain takes out of what enters the eyes, like I say, 50%, sometimes more, of what actually comes in. And it edits it on the basis of what it expects its reality to be. Not only that, the brain also adds to the information, which isn't actually there, things that relate to the brain's perceived perception of what it should be seeing. And so, if you can, in short, program someone, condition someone, and that's what's happening throughout our lives with a certain reality, that is what that person will overwhelmingly see. And how is this done? First of all, once you've programmed one generation with a certain reality, the norms in society, as I call them, they will, without any malevolence, purely out of wanting to do the best for their children, they will pass that programming on to their children as their children go up. The children then go to school where this reality is confirmed to them by teachers and professors at universities. There, every time they look at the media is confirming that reality they've been told all through their lives. All around them are their peers who are confirming to them that this reality is true because they've been through the same system. And therefore, you are programmed with a certain reality. And through this system I'm talking about, once you have taken on that reality, that program reality, that is what you see. That is what you think you see. And because the brain is editing and manipulating on the basis of this program reality, it is the greatest confirmation to people that, yes, this reality is true, because that's what they think they're seeing. And this programming, and it's happening on the subconscious level, is happening all the time. Every time you turn on the television, the programming is continuing. Every time you turn on, you talk to scientists, or you hear scientists talking about the nature of reality. Oh, yes, and this is how it works, and this is what's possible, and this is what's impossible. And, oh, no, the paranormal is not possible. I know people are experiencing it every day, but it's not possible because the laws of physics, they're an illusion as well. And if we therefore take on the idea that we are in danger, that if we put this stuff out, and oh, my, me, what's going to happen?
Hello?
Oh, there
he is. That
America in 96. America. I was talking to a man in the...
You're cutting in and out, Dave.
I did, over 3 months. Meet.
Yeah, you're cutting in and out.
A lot of whistleblowers and a lot of information out in various ways. And after about 3 weeks, very, very urging. And by the end of the 3 months, it's so obvious, it's kind of in my face. And that information out in fear of the consequences, those getting the consequences. It's not my reality, because this is an illusion we're creating. It's a holographic illusion, and people want to know. I could explain how it's created. But therefore, we are in control of the illusion if we take control of our reality. We accept what I call the consensus reality, this mass programming of this is possible, this is impossible, this is sane, this is not sane, this is bad. Then if we take on... then that's what we will live. For instance, if it's your reality that you are an ordinary man and woman in the street, I've got no power, what can I do? I'm just so public. What you will live, what you will create, is the reality in your daily experience of being an ordinary, powerless man and woman in the street who has no power over their lives. It's not because that's what you are, it's because that's what you think you are. And by the basis of our reality, we are creating a visual experience of it all the time. So if you think the consequences are going to come to you if you do something, you are going to manifest them. It is not my reality. It will never, ever be my reality that anyone can stop me doing what I'm doing. The only person that can stop me is me if I allow into my reality the possibility that that can happen. I'm not going to do that, so... no one's going to harm me. They can't. I can only harm myself.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Good night. 1-800-594-9270. That's 1-800-594-9270. You're on the Lou Gentile Show. Who am I speaking with? Hello?
Hi.
Hello?
My name is Gregory.
Yes, Gregory. And your question?
I'm sorry. Mr. Ike, I have to say that I'm honored to be able to talk to you, and I look forward to seeing you in Tyler in a couple of weeks.
That's nice. Come around the back and you make yourself known, Greg, eh?
I'd be glad to, sir. My question is, real quickly, two things. First, I heard you on an interview the other night talk about infinite love.
Uh-huh.
And I can honestly say, after listening to that interview three times, so much information has come through me, or to me,
right,
that I'm in control. And I guess that's almost scarier than knowing that you're not in control, is that you can't blame anyone anymore.
Yeah.
And the second is, of all the information you've given in your books, I've always known something was wrong, but I couldn't put my finger on it. And I think the majority of the people out there feel the same way, but they maybe have a six-pack, turn on the football, they want to gossip about who's wearing what at the Oscars. They want to escape of what's really going on. And I think your information has really said, look, here's the information of what's happening. It's there. You just have to ask yourself the questions, you know, what is going on? And try and find the truth. And
Greg, once you realize that this is an illusion, and once you realize what's going on, an illusion is only an illusion when you don't realize it's an illusion. Once you realize it's an illusion, it's not an illusion anymore because you're in control of it. It's like, you know, someone's cover being broken. Suddenly they have no power over you anymore because you know what's going on.
Right.
And when you get to that stage, you can enjoy the illusion. I mean, you know, enjoy it. And, I watch sports and all that stuff. And,
yeah,
you know, I've been known to have a beer or two. But it's I can enjoy that. but not being diverted by it, not losing the focus of what I'm doing by getting pulled into that. It's an add-on to my life. It's not, you know, my total life. The reason that so many people are looking for a way of escaping their lives is because of the disconnection they're in and the lives they're leading, the empty lives they're leading. They just want to escape from it. So they go beer and they go drugs and sports and all these different things. And what these are, the Oscars and stuff like that, they are diversions, which if you realize they're diversions, you can watch the Oscars and say, oh, that was that, I don't agree with that, I agree with that. But you're not being controlled by it. When you think when you think that all this is real and you don't realize what's actually going on and the nature of what you're experiencing, then these become traps. Because they divert you from realizing what's actually going on around you. See, if you're trying to smack a moth or something on the bum, it's very, very difficult to do it when it's flying around. But once it's mesmerized by a light, then you've got much more control of it. And basically, so many things are put into society to act like a light, to mesmerize us and pull us in. And then we're in a situation where all these things can go on around us without us having any idea they're going on, because we're not looking in that direction. We're watching the Oscars, or we're worrying about who's going to win the Super Bowl and all this stuff. And these are diversions to stop us looking behind us and seeing what's really going on. But like I say, I can enjoy them as long as you know that you know, they are diversions and you do look behind you at the same time. You know, it's not like, you know, living a life where you just focus on one thing. You can enjoy the illusion, but if you know it's an illusion, if you don't, it controls you.
Right. Thank you so much. I know you've seen the bigger picture and you have that sound like everything is going to be okay. And
everything's going to be okay because what we're looking at is an illusion. Now, this is great news because it means you can change it to another illusion, which is a nicer one. When you look through your eyes, but actually when you look through your brain, the world you actually see is no less a dream than the ones we have at night. This world is, I mean, it might sound amazing. I understand it to people listening to this for the first time, but the world is not actually solid. It's an illusion of solidity. And when you get into quantum physics and metaphysics, they're showing that the world is not actually solid. But we think it is. It just appears that way. It's just like a dream. And I've come across some fantastic information, which I'm now putting together about the nature of the reality that we're actually think is real, and it's a hologram. And when you create a hologram, what they do is they fire a laser light at a photographic print, and at the same time they divert some of that laser away from that direct hit on the print to the object they wish to photograph, and it passes across that object, and then they divert that laser light back onto the print, and at that point it collides with the part of the laser that's gone direct, and it creates what they call an interference pattern on the print symbolically. And it's like throwing two pebbles in a pond, and as the waves from the two pebbles meet and collide with each other, they create a pattern that is absolutely unique to not only the two pebbles but where in the pond those two pebbles fell. And it's an interference pattern. Now, what they do then, when you look at the holographic print, it's meaningless to you. It's just a series of wavy lines. It seems to have no form. It seems to be, what the heck is this? It's just a mass of lines. But if you then shine the same type of laser light onto that print, miraculously, a three-dimensional holographic image of what you have photographed comes into view. It's not real. It's an illusion. It's an illusion, but it's three-dimensional. Now, what appears to happen is, on the subconscious level, we are constantly sending out thought waves that are based on our reality. And those thought waves are creating thought fields, vibrational fields. The conscious level observes these fields and turns them, like the laser light on the holographic film, into a three-dimensional illusion. And it only exists when we observe it into that kind of illusory reality. What it really is a vibrational field. Now, what research has shown, scientific research, is that what the brain is a frequency decoder. So these frequency fields are basically coming in through the eyes, and the brain is decoding those frequencies into a three-dimensional holographic illusion. There is actually nothing out there so much as it's happening in here. And the principle is exactly the same as television. Television pictures are broadcast as a frequency. I mean, you know, the 6 o'clock news doesn't come over with Dan Rather. It doesn't come over the trees and over the houses, does it? You don't see it. It comes as a broadcast frequency. And the television decodes those frequencies into pictures. And that's basically, in holographic terms, what the brain is doing. And I think it was called Fourier waves or something like that. It was a mathematical sequence that was discovered by a guy called Fourier that allows television to happen. That's the way it happens. And what research has shown is this same Fourier system operates in the brain. Now, once you realize that the body, for instance, is a hologram, a lot of great mysteries about the paranormal and alternative therapies starts to disappear, because one of the fundamental amazing characteristics of a hologram is that every single part of the hologram contains the whole picture. So if you take a holographic print that I've just been describing and you cut it into, say, four pieces, when you shine the laser on any of the four pieces, you will get the whole picture. And if you do it into eight pieces, you'll still get the whole picture. It becomes less clear, of course, than the picture as a whole, but you get the whole picture. Now, because the body's a hologram, it means that every part of the body contains the whole. This is why every cell of the body contains all the information to grow a whole body, cloning. Why? Because it's a hologram, and a cell is one level of the hologram that contains the whole. In reflexology, I've identified points throughout the feet, for instance, and the hands, and other therapies use the ears, which relate to every organ in the body. And by pressing and manipulating certain points on the foot, you are actually treating different organs of the body, depending where on the foot you are. This is amazing. This is not possible. This is ludicrous. This is fantasy. No, it's a hologram. And because it's a hologram, the foot also contains a picture of the whole. Therefore, of course, it contains all the points on the foot relating to different parts of the whole body. This is how the hologram works. So we're actually looking at a holographic illusion. And what happens in terms of miraculous paranormal things is this. Whatever reality you take on and manifest in this way, if you believe in it, you will be subject to its perceived limitations. The consensus reality says, for instance, Lou, that if you walk through fire, you will burn. So what happens when people walk through fire? They burn.
Right.
However, when you, and this is what these people do, do these miraculous things, is they disconnect from consensus reality. And they operate in their own reality. And that reality, therefore, disconnects from the laws and limitations of consensus reality. And in their reality, actually, in my reality, I've decided that the fire is an illusion, my foot's an illusion, so how can an illusion burn an illusion? Thank you very much. And they walk through fire, and they're not affected by it, and they're not burnt. Why? Because it's not their reality. And what's happening all the time is that our reality is being manipulated by this network through the media, through education, through programming of various kinds, and we are living a collective dream illusion. When we disconnect from that, we are no longer subject to its laws, its impositions, and its limitations. And that's what the revolution is, the revolution of changing reality. And you don't need to stockpile weapons to change that. You just have to change yourself.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
All right, good night. Jeez. I'll tell you, you're a wealth of information over there.
We all are. You see, the thing is that what I think Greg was mentioning was when I talked about infinite love, when I talk about infinite love, I'm actually talking about the infinite I, the infinite consciousness that is all things. And infinite love is also includes infinite intelligence, also includes infinite knowing, infinite understanding. It's the infinity of all things and the balance of all things. And we, in our illusion, are in a situation where instead of being in oneness, we're in division, we're in polarity. The whole of this illusion is about polarities. It's about good and bad, good and evil, black and white, night and day. It's all duality, which stops us getting to this point that we really are, which is actually the oneness of all things. Everything is everything, and everything is everywhere. And because we are, if you like, divided in this way and polarized, we do not manifest the true magnificence of what we are, which is infinite consciousness, because we divide in the illusion of division. And one of the things that I've been kind of pondering on is how we create polarities when thinking we are doing something that is good. For instance, if you believe in the light, you also believe in the dark, because you say we must have the light to balance the dark. So if you believe in light, you're actually creating dark, because that's your reality. And if that's your reality, that's what you will create. If you believe in goodness, then you must believe in evil. If things aren't good or bad, they're not black and white. They just are. It's not light and dark. These are all illusions. These are all ways that we create polarities, dualities, and division instead of being in this oneness. Because, for instance, the left...
You have 1 minute remaining.
To create the polarity that creates the situation that this for this illusion to continue. If there is only one point... Like with a pendulum, if it has one point, if it doesn't have two points to swing between, then there is only stillness, there is only oneness. Once you have two points to vibrate between, you are creating division, duality.
That's what
the illusion is.
I have to stop you right there. We got to call you back. Remember, we're
okay.
On that England call. So I'll be calling you back in a couple minutes. We're going to take a short break and live from over in the UK. And for further information, you can check out his...
Absolutely.
Let's take some more calls here. I know we've had some people in here waiting. You're on the Lou Gentile Show. Who am I speaking with?
Hello, this is Mike in Scranton, Pennsylvania. Good morning, David.
Hello, Mike.
David, first off, just a quick comment. I don't think I'd be so open to what you're saying if, say, like in the last 15 years or so, I hadn't read so much of the work of Buckminster Fuller, who is one of the greatest American thinkers, I would say, of the last 100 years. And what he says corresponds so much to what you're saying regarding a new world order and even our perceptions of reality. And what you're saying corroborates so much of what he says. But my question is...
The two are completely connected. The nature of reality and the New World Order are completely connected, because the New World Order is manifesting by manipulating our sense of reality.
My question is, I'm kind of an internet news junkie, and I go on the various websites every day, and it's almost sickening to see the same story from ABC and NBC and CBS and BBC. Like, where does an average person go if they want to get a pretty honest take on what's really going on a day-to-day basis, besides going to books, you know?
Well, first of all, I think the bottom line is to realize there are no ordinary people. And if people see themselves in that way, then that's their reality. Like I said earlier, we are infinite consciousness. We are not ordinary. There's not an ordinary man, woman, child, blade of grass, or drop of rain in existence. It's only the extraordinary. But the internet does carry many websites now, and they're growing all the time, that are putting out alternative information to the mainstream. And there's a lot of agreement on what's going on. But in the end, you know, people need to decide their own truth. And just because a website, whether it's mine or any other, says, you know, this is our take of what's going on and all that stuff. You know, no one has a monopoly on truth. So even with these sites, we still have to put it through our own, what you might call, truth detector, intuition. Does this feel right to me? So that we build our own unique reality instead of plugging into someone else's. Because, you know, if we're going to set ourselves free and create our own unique reality that reflects us as a unique self, oneness and infinity, yes, but a unique expression of it, then we have to not take on any consensus reality. And it's no good just leaving the consensus reality of the mainstream media, i.e. what the government says is true, and then taking on another consensus reality, which is actually, that's not happening, this is really happening. Again, you know, we can get information, but we should decide for ourselves what we believe, because that's the only way of real freedom of thought and expression.
One last quick thing regarding 9/11. I also read a site occasionally, well, very occasionally, from a woman who has been on the Lucian Teal Show, Nancy Leader of ZetaTalk.com,
yeah.
And she channels the work of the Zetas, apparently. And they're suggesting that 9/11 was a slap at the arrogance of the United States, possibly from major economic forces, either in Britain or France. Is this something that would ring a bell with you?
Well, not really. I tell you for why. We have France, we have Britain, we have America, and they appear to be separate entities. And on one level, they are. I mean, you know, Americans are Americans, and French are French in the way that they perceive themselves, live their lives, and have their culture. This, the Illuminati, is not French, and it's not British, and it's not American. And it's not South African, and it's not Chinese. It works through all these different parts of global society. So it works through America, and it works through Britain. But the people who are controlling through America and controlling through Britain, representing this Illuminati agenda, they don't identify with being American. I mean, the Bush family don't identify with what's best for America. They identify with what's best for the Illuminati agenda. So do the people who are representing the Illuminati in France and Germany and all around the world and all these different things. The country is merely their sphere of influence to advance the agenda. They don't identify with being that nationality because they're beyond that. They just
right, they're definitely trans.
So America doesn't get slapped by the Illuminati because it's getting arrogant and all that stuff. America is used by the Illuminati to advance an agenda. Now, for me, and I feel for Americans. I'm married to an American, but I feel for Americans in many ways because the more I've done this research, the more it's clear that the real power in terms of this global agenda is not in America at all. It just appears to be. It's actually in Europe and has been for a very long time. Now, if you don't want people to look in the direction of where the real power is, what do you want? You want them to look the other way. And in so many ways, they have set America up as the fall guy, as the superpower. And, of course, most people in the world, understandably, they look to America as being the cause of things. It's the great Satan. Look what it's doing. What is actually happening is forces in the Illuminati in Europe are loading the guns, and they're getting the American wing of the Illuminati to fire them. So everyone's looking at America, look, it's America, that's the problem, and they're looking in the wrong direction because the real power that's manipulating that is in Europe, but people aren't looking that way. I mean, tremendous concentration of Illuminati operations is in Britain. But, of course, people don't look to Britain and say, oh, Britain's controlling the world. They say, it's just a small country. And Britain's saying, yes, we used to have an empire, but we're just a fading empire now, and we're just a little country. That's where the real power is. But no one looks there. They look to America.
Well, thank you, David. Very engaging.
It's a diversion.
Right.
So American society and American people get the flack But it's the it's not like that. They're the fall guys in so many ways.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the comment. Good night. 1-800-594-9270. That's 1-800-594-9270.
Incidentally, Lou, I don't know whether you've come across this. Tell me if you have. But this is something very relevant to what's going on in the world at the moment that has actually come to light. And if people are saying, oh, you know, it's all a conspiracy theory, well, this may make them think again. Whether you've come across this, it's a document that was put together for the very people that are controlling the present administration in America. And it was called Strategies, Forces, and Resources for a New Century, created by a think tank called Project for the New American Century. And it was written for these people in September 2000. Have you come across that?
Not really.
Tell me if this makes rings any bells, because I came across this document when I was researching Alice in Wonderland, but it's actually been published in a British newspaper now called the Sunday Herald in Scotland, and this is just the report in that newspaper, which is a very good summary of it. And I emphasize again, this document was written in September 2000. Bush wasn't even elected at the time. It says, a secret blueprint for U.S. global domination. For U.S. global domination, exactly what I was talking about a few seconds ago, read Illuminati using America for global domination. A secret blueprint for U.S. global domination reveals that President Bush and his cabinet were planning a premeditated attack on Iraq to secure regime change even before he took power in January 2001. The blueprint for the creation of a global Pax Americana was drawn up for, here's the gang, Dick Cheney, now Vice President, Donald Rumsfeld, now Defense Secretary, Paul Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld's deputy, George W. Bush's younger brother Jeb, and Louis Libby, Cheney's Chief of Staff. And it was called Strategies, Forces, and Resources for a New Century. Now, the plan shows Bush's cabinet intended to take military control of the Gulf region whether or not Saddam Hussein was in power. It says, the United States has for decades sought to play a more permanent role in the Gulf region security. While the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification to go in there, this is in September 2000, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of regime change of Saddam Hussein. The document supports a, quote, blueprint for maintaining global U.S. preeminence, precluding the rise of a great power rival, and shaping the international security order in line with American principles and interests, i.e. Illuminati. This American grand strategy must be advanced for as far into the future as possible, this document says. It also calls for the U.S. to, quote, fight and decisively win multiple simultaneous major theater wars as a core mission. And it describes the American armed forces, those now shooting and being shot at in Iraq, it describes American armed forces abroad as the, quote, cavalry on the new American frontier. Now, this is among the key elements of it. See if this makes any sense to current events. The document refers to key allies such as the UK as the most effective and efficient means of exercising American global leadership. It describes peacekeeping missions as demanding American political leadership rather than that of the United Nations. It says that even should Saddam pass from the scene, bases in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait will remain permanently, despite domestic opposition in the Gulf regimes to the stationing of U.S. troops, as, quote, Iran may well prove as large a threat to U.S. interests as Iraq has. And, of course, Iran was one of the three countries in the so-called Axis of Evil. And what does it also mention, September 2000, the other country in the Axis of Evil, talking about North Korea and how that regime needs to be a part of this whole strategy. Now, what I've been writing for some years because of contacts, Lou, that I've met around the world, is that this agenda has as one of its kind of key elements is creating a conflict with China. I've been writing this in my books for many years. What does this document say? And imagine what this would mean in terms of what's happened in the world. The document according to this newspaper report, spotlights China for regime change, saying it is time to increase the presence of American forces in Southeast Asia. This, it says, may lead to American and allied power providing the spur to the process of democratization in China. Global war. I mean, what the heck does that mean? But that is absolutely in line with what I've been picking up for the last 10 years and more about where this agenda wants to lead. It wants to lead to a conflict with China. Now, all that, December 2000,
it's very
before the Bush administration went in, and it's all unfolding before our eyes. Why? Because it's the agenda. That's why they were going to invade Iraq, no matter what. All this stuff, United Nations must have another second resolution. It's all the movie. They were going to go into Iraq. They always were. Not because of weapons of mass destruction, but because that was the policy of getting into that region and taking over that area. They just found an excuse.
This is scary.
This is how they do it. Find an excuse to do what they want to do anyway.
David, this is scary. Do you find this frightening information or what?
Because it's all an illusion. I mean, it depends what level you look at it, and we can change the illusion. This is just their agenda. It's only going to happen if we sit around and allow it to happen. See, these guys have no power unless we give them. The power that they use to do these things is merely the power we give away. If Bush comes to a podium at the White House and says, we've had a discussion, and this is what we're going to do, and the public say in large enough numbers, no, we're not. They have no power. They only have power. We say, oh, well, we better do. I don't agree with it, but it's the law. And what we need in the five-sense level of this is, the approach of Gandhi, which is not violence. We meet violence with violence. What do you get? You get twice the violence. Well, we've moved on. But non-cooperation. What we're doing all the time, Lou, is building and supporting our own prison. When we take away that contribution, when we cease to cooperate with the structure that is controlling us, then the structure falls apart because we stop holding it together. And that's what we need to do. You see, I mean, I know it's maybe a big leap, but there are troops fighting now in Iraq on the American-British side, and they're fighting troops who are fighting on the Iraqi side. Now, Saddam Hussein ain't fighting George Bush and Tony Blair. The troops are doing it. And I have this absolutely perfect, I think, foolproof means of stopping war, including the war in Iraq. What you do is you make it the law that anyone who declares war has to fight in the front line from day one.
Hmm.
End of war.
Well,
if that
had to
happen now, George Bush would be in the front line in the desert. You know, he might be in the desert when the first gun was fired, but he'd be under a bed in Houston when the second one went off. I mean, this is a guy who is talking on television now about we are making great strides, we are making advances. Georgie boy, we ain't doing anything. We are watching the sports on the White House television. They are fighting the war, not you. And without the acquiescence of the people, these things would not be possible. And I've got a wonderful quote, Lou, that sums up what I'm saying here about the way that the troops, etc., are manipulated. And it's by a guy, and this is not new. This was a guy speaking, I think, back in the 1930s. A guy called Major General Smedley Butler. Now, he was twice awarded the Medal of Honor while serving more than 30 years in the United States Marine Corps. And he says this, like all the members of the military profession, I never had a thought of my own until I left the service. My mental faculties remained in suspended animation while I obeyed the orders of higher-ups. This is how the pyramid works. This is typical, he says, with everyone in the military service. I helped make Mexico, especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped to make Haiti and Cuba decent places for the National Citibank boys to collect revenues in. I helped with the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1909 to 1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. In China, I helped to see that Standard Oil went its way unmolested. This is what the military are actually being used for, to advance an agenda they don't realize exists. Now, once we can start to get people to see this, and so many, Lou, former service people come on to me and say, I can see what was happening now when I was in the military. These are decent people, most of them. You know, they are like the guy in the CIA I mentioned earlier. They are believe they're serving the country, but they've been sold a lie, so that they think they're doing one thing, but actually what they're doing is this Smedley Butler found out later is actually they're serving an agenda they don't know exists. Now, if we can start getting people to walk away from playing their part in this agenda because they realize the agenda exists, then the power of these people disappears. And that's what we need to do. Information is the power, not stockpiling weaponry to, you know, take these guys on with guns. I mean, that's just insane.
All right, let's take – I know there's people dying to talk to you. So let's take 10 minutes of doing nothing but some phone lines, and then we're going to go into this book, and I want to go into this reptilian stuff.
Okay.
And I got a couple other questions and whatnot, and then we'll take it from there. All right. You're on the Lou Gentile Show. Who am I speaking with?
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Lou. Hello, David. This is Neil King, from California.
Hello, mate.
I'm going to add a string to your bow, first of all, mate. You're a good matchmaker. I'm sitting
really?
With my girlfriend, Lisa, and we met at your talk in Santa Clara in California.
Right.
So thanks for that. You want to send
oh,
that.
That's good.
And just actually,
yeah, I'm going back there in September, I think.
That's right, yeah, September, that's right.
I think.
But it's just a couple of comments, I think, you might expand on them when I finish too, is that
okay.
It was really good that you were just talking about being in the military and ex-military coming out, because I'm back myself, I'm ex-British Army for 7 years.
Right.
And totally understand about what you're saying about how you believe completely what's been, what's going on, you're doing a good job. Unfortunately for me, though, is that when I came out, I had the experience of working in with the Foreign Office as well. And so I actually started to see a little bit of a different picture before coming out. But, again, that's another different story. But on a more positive note, what I found when we're talking about freeing ourselves from the illusion is that, I think in layman's terms, I don't know if you'll agree with this or expand on it any, is that it's actually following my instinct and actually what intrinsically makes me feel, as best as I can about anything, which has led me on, like, a path which resulted in, say, Santa Clara last October. And along the way, I think the feedback you get, I think we call them synchronicities most of the time.
Yeah.
That you're on the right path. Sometimes it's not pleasant, but again, that's just a perspective. So what I'm trying to say is, maybe when people are listening to saying about, talking about holographic nature of things and how do you go about doing this, what I found myself is that being able to be less mesmerized by what's going on around this agenda being played out, and trusting more in your intrinsic kind of instinct and following that, rather than being affected by the events going on around us. I don't know if that makes any sense to you, if it helps clarify for anybody listening, you know, about how we can actually get through these times and come out the other end, you know, in a better way. I don't know.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think this is a very, very important point you've brought up, and I actually experienced this. It's actually what changed my life dramatically in the early 90s or late 80s. The difference between intuitive knowing, some people call it feeling, and the head thinking. The head, what's known ludicrously as the logical mind, is a manipulator's dream. Because its reality is this five-sense world, and it sees the world in terms of parts, it sees the world in terms of logic, and you have to think, and you have to plan, and you have to do this. If you want to do something, you've got to plan it all out. But if you follow your intuition, what you feel to do rather than what you think to do, and in this world they're often, if not all the time, completely at odds, then you are accessing a level of yourself, a level of your infinite self that is beyond the illusory mind. And suddenly you find that when you follow this intuition, as you rightly say, you might get yourself in a bit of apparent trouble sometimes from a five-sense conditioned reality point of view, but everything works out brilliantly in the end. And what happened to me was, and this changed my life, is that in the late 80s, I decided that I was going to do something, and it, my intuition said, don't do it, mate. Don't do it. Don't feel right about this. My head said, look, no, it's all very logical. It looks all fine to me. And I did it, and it didn't work out at all. And what I said was to myself, I'm never going to go against my intuition again. And I never have from that day forward. And what happens is you can, by following your intuition and doing what your intuition tells you, you can get yourself in some, you know, interestingly challenging situations because you suddenly start beating to a different drum to the world around you. For instance, in the early 1990s, I had tremendous ridicule in Britain when I first came out with this. But my intuition said, do it, do it. And my head was going, hold on a minute, you know, what are you doing? Everyone's bloody laughing and you're being ridiculed and all that. Oh, my God. So, but I just stayed with it. And what happened in the end is that everything started to work out magnificently. And not only work out not despite all the ridicule and all the stuff I went through, but work out because of it. And what happens is your head, your logical head, starts observing the fact that, hold on a minute, you might get some challenges when you follow your intuition, but in the end, everything works out perfectly. So the head's logic starts to say, hey, you know, there's something in this. And at that point, your head starts to come into line with your intuition. And you reach a point where what you feel intuitively and what you think with your head are the same thing. And that war stops in yourself, within yourself, between what you think to do and what you feel to do. And what am I saying here? I'm saying we're bringing two polarities together into oneness again. We're moving out of the world of polarity and duality, division, into oneness by bringing the mind and, the heart, the intuitive self, into oneness. And they work then together instead of fighting each other. And it's a fantastic feeling. And if people follow their intuition, they will always end up where they need to be. People say, how have you put all this information together in such a short time, like 1.5 million words in my last five books? I couldn't have done it without following my intuition. If my intuition told me now, get on a plane to India in the morning, I'd be on a plane to India in the morning. And every time I followed my intuition, my head said, hey, can you really afford this? Should you really be going here? I thought you were going to do this. Now, wouldn't this be nicer? When I followed my intuition, I've walked into people who have given me information. I've walked into situations that I've experienced to learn more about this whole thing that's going on. My intuition is what has led me to this information. And if I had not followed that, I could not possibly have compiled this in the time I have. Impossible.
All right. Thanks for the call, sir.
Okay, thank you.
All right, good night. 1-800-594-9270. That's 1-800-594-9270. Phone lines are sponsored by Northstar-Technologies.com. Check them out, guys. 3.9 cents. You can't go wrong. And actually, he even sent me a thing over tonight telling me about these great long-distance rates for international calls. So I don't have to use these friggin' phone cards. All right. So anyway, Northstar-Technologies.com. Check them out. Excuse me. All right, let's take another caller here. You're on the Lou Gentile Show. Who am I speaking with?
This is Sal calling from Conyers, Georgia.
Yeah, Sal, what's your question?
Good evening to you. Good morning, David.
Hello, mate.
Yeah, I had a couple of questions, actually, but I know you're kind of trying to trim it down now. So I guess I'll just ask the second one. Now, I was looking at that archive that you have on your website of the protesters in Hyde Park.
Uh-huh.
The archive of them. You had a link for it on your website.
And, yeah, I think the webmaster put that on, yeah.
Yeah, one particular woman's interview stuck in my mind. She you could tell she was sincerely against the things that are currently being made to happen, and she really was willing to do whatever was in her power to affect some change. But at the end of her statement, she basically, it seemed like she was just conceding that war was probably, in fact, inevitable. And you know, that made me sad because I realized how much the mood has changed really since, like, the 60s, for example. The advantage those people had back then was that, you know, they hadn't been through it before, and they, they really believed that they were going to change the world. You know, their energies were running strong, and their music was unbridled, unrestrained, unlike the music today in America, at least. I don't want to come off sounding like a pessimist, but it seems like my question to you is basically, how do we recapture that vitality we had back then, and learn not to squander it and focus it?
Well, it's about the foundation. For me, is understanding that we're creating reality so we can create another one. If we don't understand that, then we unknowingly, even from the best of intentions, add our power to the illusion and the manipulation. For instance, you see, beyond this illusion is not a world of vibration. It's a world of stillness, because it's oneness, and oneness has one point, because it's only one. Therefore, it doesn't vibrate and oscillate between two polarities, because it's only one. It's the oneness of all. So if it vibrates, it's illusion. And to create a vibrational illusions, you need two points of oscillation so that the vibration can happen. So like I said earlier, you need the left in politics, but you need the right, and the right needs the left to create this polarity. And if, in those same terms, the protesters against things like war set themselves up as a polarity to those who are for war, then they set up a vibrational field, and the illusion continues, because vibrations need this oscillation between two points. This is why this whole illusion is based on polarities, for this very reason. Illusion, vibration is illusion. These thought fields that we think into illusory reality are vibrational fields. Now, so if we come from a point of aggression and what have you and what have you, we are creating a polarity which the Illuminati want. They don't care why conflict and division goes on, so long as it does. So we need to come from this point of oneness and understanding that we create in our own reality, and create a different reality rather than creating another point of conflict between those protesting and those not protesting, because in the end, the vibrational field of the illusion, the, if you like, the consensus reality, the basic vibrational blueprint that we live within, in the end, that will, if you look at physics, if you have a master vibration and you bring something, another vibration in to disrupt it, eventually, often very quickly, that dominating vibration will bring the disruptive vibration into its own beat, and it will encompass it. And the disrupting vibration will no longer be disrupting. It will be beating to the master blueprint. And this is what is happening when people challenge the system. The system eventually, because it's an oscillation, it's a vibrational field, it will bring the disrupting vibration into itself, and this will manifest itself in society as protests and demand for change, going so far and then fading as people get pulled back into the system and stop you know, being a disruptive influence to it. So what we need to do is we need to change that beat. We need to change the vibrational field that is the illusion, and we can only do that by beating to a different drum. And that means disconnecting from being a clone or a prisoner of this consensus reality, and expressing our uniqueness. You know, you don't even have to go on a protest march to do that. You just have to express it in your everyday life. Express you as you are. Say what you really think. Do what you really believe you want to do. Don't hide. Don't, as the Japanese have a national saying, which says, don't be the nail that stands out above the rest, because that's the first one to get hit.
Yeah.
But when you do it, you don't do it for a week. You don't go on a protest march and say, oh, I'm challenging, and then you go back into the system and do this. You do it as a permanent, ongoing thing. And the more people that do it, the more the whole reality changes, because you start to challenge this consensus reality blueprint that people are mesmerized and controlled by, and they start to dismantle it. You stop holding the system together. We're doing it with our own minds. So the real answer is changing our own reality so we change consensus reality. You can do that, you know, going around the supermarket. You just beat to a different drum. You live your life in your unique way. And the whole system will start to fall then because we stop holding it together.
Right. You just reminded me of that Dead Poets Society when he takes
exactly,
them into the courtyard.
Exactly, great movie.
And they all start marching. It's kind of chaotic at first, and then they kind of fall into the pattern. And then he shows them, wait, stop, there it is, the dangers of conformity. And then, of course, you had Charlie that was the one that actually was exercising the right to not walk at all, to not march at all.
Exactly. That Dead Poets Society, funnily enough, mate, I was only watching it the other day because it is a great movie. And there was another point of the movie, you'll remember, where he gets the students in his class to actually stand on the desk. And he says, look, get up here and, you know, the world looks different from up here. In other words, observe the world from a different point of observation and you'll see that actually it's not necessarily like you thought it was. And this consensus reality is so important because it is basically, it's what Jung called the collective unconscious. It's a level of our consciousness where we all agree that on a certain reality. And we get pulled into it. And the more people accept the consensus reality, the more power it has, because the more minds are manifesting its illusions by believing in it. expressing your uniqueness, beating to a different drum, being the nail that stands out above the rest, and realizing you can be. And then these other nails, they all look up and say, hold on a minute. You can stand out above the rest, and it's fine. No one hits you unless you create that reality. So more nails start standing out above the rest, and then suddenly more nails are standing out than aren't standing out. The whole reality has changed. The whole society has changed. The whole point of the power has changed. But it takes that first step, which does in that sense need courage, of stepping out of the pen, stepping out of the norms. Taking the ridicule and condemnation by people that don't understand what you're trying to do, and that does need courage to take that first step. But what you find in the end is once you reach a point where you let go of fear, which is the four-letter word that controls the world, you realize you don't need courage because courage is overcoming fear. When you don't have fear, you don't need courage to overcome it because you haven't got it. You just are. You just do what you believe to be right all the time without going through this mental gymnastics. Oh, yes, but what will happen if I say this? What will happen if I do this? Oh, will people laugh at me? Will people say I'm dangerous or mad? You don't go through that. You just do. You just are. You just are what you are, and you speak your truth, and whatever it is, and you are completely at peace without anyone receives it. That is a completely different vibrational reality state to the consensus reality. The more people that break out of the pen and do that, the more this whole matrix blueprint will start to fall. Because that movie, The Matrix, I know there's some more coming out, but that first one was absolutely the best visual representation of the illusion that we actually live in.
That was when was the moment that you actually saw what a useful metaphor that was for our actual world scenario?
Well, I saw it immediately because the first time I watched it because I was already moving in that direction. But there's some wonderful lines in it which actually relate to what we've been talking about on Lou's show tonight. For instance, the little boy who holds up the spoon,
right.
And the Neo character sits down next to him, and he sees the spoon bend.
Right.
And the little boy said, "Don't try to bend the spoon; that is impossible. Just try to understand the truth. There is no spoon. It is not the spoon that bends. It is only yourself. Exactly what we do. The spoon is a vibrational field. Whether it bends or not depends on how our brain decodes that reality." The whole theme and visual representation of that movie was the world that we live in. And you remember when he goes into where to see the oracle, and the oracle says to him, "Don't worry about the vase." And a second later, the vase falls off the table and smashes. And he's going, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry. I'm terribly sorry." And the oracle lady says to him, "What's really going to fry your noodle, or worse to that effect, is if I hadn't have mentioned it, would it have happened?" And so that is so symbolic. What happens is that we are constantly programmed with things that we take on to be real and take on that might happen. And therefore, because it becomes our reality, we create it. I mean, you know when doctors say to people, you've got 6 months to live and there's nothing we can do, how many of those people die in around 6 months? Because it's their reality. These things are being programmed into us all the time, and then we decode them into a holographic version of what we've taken on. I mean, do you know something? What the research for this book I'm doing at the moment, just to give you some examples of what I'm talking about in terms of this reality thing and how we create it. They've done double-blind experiments with LSD, where they give half the people LSD and they give half of them a placebo that is absolutely of no use at all, just a sugar pill or something.
Right.
People on the sugar pill trip to the same extent and for the same amount of time as those on LSD. They have done double-blind placebo tests with chemotherapy drugs in which people on the placebo, just like a sugar pill, have actually lost all their hair. Because the placebo, the belief in that the placebo is actually the drug that they think has a certain effect, is taken on as their reality. And therefore, even though it's not the drug, their brain mind thinks it is, and so it creates the reality of how it thinks that drug will affect it. This is happening all the time, and the Illuminati is the battlefield on which they control the human race, the manipulation of our reality, because they understand the way the system works.
All right. Thanks for the call, man.
Thank you. I'll see you in Tyler.
Oh, great, mate. Smashing.
All right.
All right. Good.
Thanks.
All right. We'll take another quick question here, and we got to take a break in about 3 minutes. You're on the Lou Gentile Show. Who am I speaking with?
This is Ron.
Yes, Ron.
Oh, hi, David. It's a pleasure to speak with you. I heard you on KPFK just last week.
All right.
I'm reading some of your books right now, and also Stuart Wilde talks about you as well. I've read a lot
of Stuart Wilde, yeah. I met him a little while ago, yeah, in Ireland.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is kind of a little off the subject a little bit. Your voice reminds me a lot of John Lennon's, and I wonder if you had ever met John.
No, I can't sing either. But I've a lot of respect for some of the things he tried to do.
Right. I just wondered if you'd ever met him and what you think of who the Beatles were actually, because it kind of links into the last gentleman's call as well about that idealism, which I'm from that era as well, and in these times I'm really working on keeping that alive in myself. And the Beatles are part of that mindset.
Yeah, I think the Beatles were, the whole thing was manipulated to an extent in the 60s without their knowledge. But I think one of the things that Lennon did was he sussed that. He realized that the Beatles machine was being manipulated and got out of it.
Right.
But it's very clear from his lyrics that he understood many of the things that we're talking about tonight, about the nature of reality and everything. I think he made a very good contribution to waking a lot of people up. And I actually saw a copy of the file the FBI had on John Lennon, which was released to someone I knew under the Freedom of Information Act. And all I can say is even under that act, almost all of it was blacked out.
Exactly.
They obviously had a problem with him, and I have no doubt at all that the guy who shot him actually was one of these mind controlled people from government mind control projects, where they literally programmed them to carry out assassinations and what have you, so that it won't lead back anywhere. I mean, people just ask, how many times are people assassinated by, quote, lone nutters? What they do is they put people from these mind control projects, they put them out in society, and they're programmed to be a little bit strange to people. And so when they're then activated to carry out assassinations or whatever, the media go to people that have known them and people, neighbors and what have you, and they say, yeah, he never was really the full picnic. He was always weird. And,
right.
And the people say, yes, he was just a nutter. Oh, my goodness me. When really they're controlled to do that by forces that want these people removed.
And then
John Lennon was an example of that.
In another way, by them labeling those people as such, they're negating that individualism and that different drummerism that you're speaking about, so they can show that as being wrong.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I've understood as I've been researching this book, and that what actually manifests itself as a physical event that we see, like an assassination or someone being ridiculed or attacked by the IRS or whatever, is actually the physical representation of the prevailing vibrational field, i.e. this consensus reality I talk about,
right.
Actually bringing disruptive vibrational fields that are challenging its preeminence into line. It's this oscillation bringing these challenging vibrations into line and absorbing them and removing them. And it manifests itself in our five-sense reality as people being assassinated, as people being jailed, as people being destroyed financially by the IRS and what have you. But it's actually what's actually happening is it's a vibrational field defending itself.
All right, guys, going to take a short break. Thanks for the call, man.
Thanks, Lou. Yeah, it's funny enough you mentioned that. I mean, what you find when you talk about this stuff and people, you know, come on and listen to these programs and make their contributions is, the level of intelligence is, let's say, rather more impressive than, the talk show hosts who, in the system, talking about the system, believe in the system. What's his name? That guy who's always going on about the Republicans and what have you on American mainstream
Rush
talk show host and
Rush Limbaugh.
Winbore.
Yeah, exactly.
The level of intelligence on programs like this one, when we're talking about this sort of information, is so much higher. And there's a simple reason for that, because people here have begun to see beyond the illusion, and they're not caught in it. Anything like, and we're all caught in it to an extent, but anything like you get with those that, believe what they're told. And it's a joy to talk to people, really.
Well, it is. I just get sick and tired of there's some shows that I do that, it just turns into one big infomercial, and I sit here and I say to myself, if these people only knew how much it takes for everything that has to go into this, and here they are spieling off, and they want to get like 6,000 orders the next day. It just dulls down what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to bring the paranormal and reality out in all this. And I'm not here to authors I could care less about. I want people to buy books. I want people to read. I want people to explore things as far as reading. But as far as a lot of this garbage that some of these people throw at me sometimes, I just sit there and I'm like in la la land, and I'm like, it's just ridiculous.
The thing is that getting the information out is the most important thing. And if people are interested, then they'll read the books anyway. I mean,
yeah.
You have to go around kind of, being a book salesman. And, if people read my books, great. If they don't, equally great. It may sound strange, but, either way, I'm at peace with that. Because why should people read my books if they don't feel to? If they don't feel to, that's right. Express your uniqueness. I'm not reading his books. Don't read them. Great. At least you're making a decision rather than taking someone else's.
Exactly. But, now I want to, we only have about 20 minutes left. This sucks.
Okay.
Because I need like 8 hours for you.
Right.
So
we're not
much.
Even touched on 911 now. Yeah. That's 3 hours in itself.
I'm telling you, geez, you gotta have like 3 hour shows on each of your books. Yeah, you better come here every single month.
you know, I'd like to have you on the show every month if you can.
Right, well, that'd
be
nice.
I know you're running around, but I think North Star is gonna hook us up with some international calling, so we don't, I don't have to use these frigging calling cards because I always objected to.
Okay.
Because you know I get an itchy finger. You know, sometimes I'll be like, you know what? Let me get this guest over here in Ethiopia. You know, and I start calling or something. But I think it'd be pretty good. You know, get you on here once a month, and you know we could talk about these different books because you got a lot of information, and you know I think people should at least read your books and find out a little bit about what's going on, because what you're talking about sounds like you're talking about it from the heart and from experience instead of, you know, trying to pitch just some, you know, major, you know, whatever. You know what I mean?
Well, the thing is, you know, my life, Lou, has been experiencing things and learning from the experience. You know, and there's no substitute for experiencing something to really understand it. I mean, what better to help an alcoholic than someone who's been an alcoholic? You get much more help from someone like that than someone who's read about alcoholism in a book somewhere or took a course at college, you know.
Right.
So it can be challenging sometimes, but I do like experiencing things, and because you understand them more, really.
Sure. Well, that's what it's about. I mean, especially, you know, being involved with the paranormal, it's about having experiences with things, finding out new information.
Yeah, I've had a few, Lou, in the last few months in terms of, you know, altered state experiences, which has absolutely opened my understanding of the nature of the way things work and how we create reality and how it's manipulated in a way I didn't have before. So,
now, out of curiosity, you know, we've talked a lot about the different books or about the one book, your views on 9/11. Let me get some of these instant messages out that were not answered during the show. Somebody, let's see. Okay, this is from Matt in Ohio. Says, please ask David, is there a relationship between the war on terrorism and the ongoing war on drugs? Are these people controlling wars on the same, what is this? Are these people controlling wars, one in the same war now? Do illegal drugs fund terrorism?
Oh, absolutely they do. And it's, you know, it's funny, we talk about everything being connected. Well, everything's connected anywhere you look. Even this whole level of the manipulation is a series of apparent constituent parts that are actually all connected in that pyramid system I talked about. And they are they're connected by this, really, the agenda. You have the agenda, which is for centralization of power on a global scale and absolute control of the people. Now, people talk about the conspiracies and all that stuff. The way that different conspiracies connect into one conspiracy is the agenda and their relationship to it. For instance, there are conspiracies to suppress information and to remove and marginalize people who are putting out information to expose the conspiracy. There are conspiracies to put into positions of power, like presidents and prime ministers, etc., those who will advance the agenda through legislation in those positions of power. And there are others, conspiracies, to stop people getting into those positions of power who will not advance the agenda. So you get things like assassinations of Kennedy or what have you. You have the manipulation of George Bush through the ludicrous non-election in Florida into power through the Supreme Court, which had a Bush family majority on it. And they don't seem to be connected on the face of it, but they are, because they're related to putting someone into power to advance the agenda, which this guy is now doing, and removing someone who was not playing the agenda's game at that time, which was Kennedy in 63. So all these different apparently unconnected conspiracies fit together, and the drugs thing is very much part of that. I mean, the BCCI, the Bank of Crooks and Criminals International, as it was called, was a CIA operation, along with other elements of the Illuminati, to run drugs and to launder drug money, to fund terrorist groups, etc. And just to give you an idea, excuse me, Luke, how these things connect and how things that apparently are not connected to something are fundamentally connected, let's just put some strands here in terms of the BCCI. First of all, the 20% major shareholder of that bank was a guy called Khalid bin Mahfouz. Khalid bin Mahfouz was named by the Clinton State Department as a funder of bin Laden. Khalid bin Mahfouz was a investor in an energy company, an oil company, of George W. Bush, the present president. Just as bin Mahfouz was controlling, in effect, the BCCI, he's also a major associate of the bin Laden family in Saudi Arabia, the same bin Laden family who were also investors in the present president's oil companies. One of the business associates of the bin Laden family is Father George Bush through an organization called the Carlyle Group. George Bush is an advisor, the father, to the Saudi royal family, who are extremely close to the bin Laden family, and lots of money has been funneled through the royal family of Saudi Arabia into Al-Qaeda.
Is this why we're not going after Saudi Arabia for anything?
Well, yeah. I know someone who was very close to Father George Bush, and she told me that George Bush described Saudi Arabia as the 51st American state. Such was its control. In effect, because of the nature of Saudi Arabia, all you have to do is control the royal family and you control the country. And let me give you this clue. I mean, just to tell you how ludicrous it gets. You remember that there was a terrorist bomb that virtually destroyed a building in Saudi Arabia in a U.S. military compound. It was called the Khobar Towers. It killed a number of Americans and many Saudis. And what the State Department did was they blamed Osama bin Laden and his terrorist network for that bomb that destroyed the Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia. Guess who got the contract to rebuild it? Bin Laden Construction in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, the family business of Osama bin Laden. They bombed in Afghanistan. They bombed these tunnel complexes they said were bin Laden's headquarters. What they didn't tell you is that they were built with American CIA money by bin Laden Construction of Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. I mean, you know, the real story is that these guys are connected. They only are apparently unconnected on the movie version we get on CNN and the mainstream news. And one of the things about drugs is another fundamental foundation of the conspiracy, the agenda, is to suppress humanity's humanity manifesting its true power and its true potential. They want to suppress that for obvious reasons. Also, they want conflict in society. They want division. And running the drugs actually achieves all those things. Not least, if you look, and I've seen figures in this country, it must be the same in America, if you look at the number of crimes that are committed every year by people who are desperately trying to get money to feed their drug habit, it's absolutely fantastic. So by having this whole drug culture, they are actually creating the very foundation to create crime on a massive scale, which creates fear, which creates division, and all the rest of exactly what they want. And when you do the research, you find that, for instance, the Bush family are major players and have been for decades in the global drug running racket. You have a deputy secretary of state in America, Armitage. Armitage ran drugs for the CIA in Southeast Asia under the cover of the Vietnam War. I mean, these people are the CIA actually set up the drug cartels in Colombia so that they had, if you like, a simpler organization to do business with than all the individual drug barons that were going before. This is what's really going on. Panama, Noriega, as has been well documented by a number of researchers, was on the CIA payroll and being paid $100,000 a year a long time ago to allow Panama to be used by the CIA and the Illuminati drug operation as a center for moving drugs through up into America. When Noriega fell out with Father George Bush, that's when Bush sent the troops in and removed him, saying, oh, yes, he's running drugs. We must stop him and save our children. What they didn't tell you is the people really running the drugs were Father George Bush and his network. Yeah. What they did, and this is easily documentable, is what they replaced after they removed Noriega. They replaced him with a regime that was absolutely packed with representatives of the South American drug cartels. And they sent the troops in, like they are in Iraq, to remove Noriega to save the kids of America. No, more drugs were moved through Panama after Noriega than before.
You think a lot of this is because some of these people that are, quote-unquote, their associates, get greedy and finally just want more and more? You know what I mean?
Yeah, what happens, Louis, that in this pyramid structure that I talked about, if you are actually in the public eye, you're nowhere near the top. You're nearer than most people, but you're not near the top. The people really running this structure, they don't put themselves on public display. They don't stand for elected office. They let their gophers, in effect, do that. And take the flak. And the gophers, while they appear to have power, like the President of the United States, Prime Minister of Britain, they're just pawns in the game. They're used for as long as they're useful, and then they're removed. In fact, they're even removed in a very unpleasant way or exposed for this, that, and the other, and held up to public disdain and ridicule if that suits the agenda to do so. So people like Noriega are even they're just real pawns in the game. They are used while they're useful, but soon, as you point out, they start to become something that is disruptive because they're believing their own publicity that they're actually in control of their country. Then they're removed. And if someone like George Bush, the present president, if he became an influence that was bad for the agenda, they'd just remove him. They'd find a way of removing him. This is the way they work. They're just gophers. They have power, but only over people below them in the pyramid. They are under the control of those higher than them.
David, do you have an extra till like 12 or till 1:15?
Yeah, I could do that. It's now 5 to 6. I watched, it is England, isn't it? I almost said I watched the sun come up. I watched the clouds come up out of my window. It's starting to get light here, so
I'm sure
I could do another 20 minutes, yeah.
Yeah, I just want to tackle some other questions and whatnot.
Okay.
And get rid of the people we have on the phone lines. All right, let's take some calls. You're on the Lou Gentile Show. Who am I speaking with?
Neil from New York.
Yes, sir.
3 points here. Question, in regards to not going along with the system, I'm looking at the example of Venezuela that doesn't seem to be working despite the mass citizen protests. And then number two, I find it interesting that David's mentioning, go from external control to internal control. But your analogy you're using is, simply don't listen to the current drummer. Who's to say that the powers that be right now can't simply co-opt the next new drummer? And then my third point is, how come you're not around the U.S. more? We need some enlightenment here.
Basically, I'll go where I'm invited, mate. And
if I invite you, you'll come?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think Indianapolis is coming up this year, and Santa Clara and Texas. But apart from that, I'm open to more, obviously. But in terms of the question about, why can't they not just change the drama a little bit and pull us into another one? Yes, they can. I think they're doing it all the time. On a very superficial level, they've sold the invasion of Iraq in so many different ways when one way has not worked. First it was regime change. Oh, no, that doesn't go down too well. Oh, no, it's weapons of mass destruction. Oh, no, it's this. Oh, no, it's that. Oh, we must go through the UN. Oh, no, we don't have to go through the UN. And so they changed the story to get the outcome they want. So, yes, they can. And this is why it's so important that we get into this point of knowingness, which is beyond manipulation. The mind can be manipulated easy. That's the level at which we are manipulated. But if we get into this intuitive level beyond mind, then we can feel instinctively, intuitively, whether something feels right to us or not. And it is a major, magnificent way of sifting through the constant barrage of illusions and diversions that are thrown at us to keep us from seeing the game. So without that intuitive knowing, now, I know it makes sense. I know it seems to make sense, but there's something about it doesn't feel right, that kind of level. Without that, then you know, they'll go on manipulating us, which is why we need to move from head to heart symbolically and start intuitively feeling the world rather than mentally thinking it, because, you know, we can get mesmerized that way.
Well, not that you can answer this phone call, but maybe on your website or through other means you can start giving some practical applications we can make that transition. You know, I hear what you're saying, and I agree with it, but I can't be more intellectual. I don't know quite how to go back to the heart.
I think I was talking to someone in Brazil when I was down there in Amazon doing something, and he said, "Look, I'd love to get into this intuitive level, but I can't get out of my head. I can't stop thinking. How do I stop thinking?" And the only thing I said to him was, "Don't try, because in trying to stop thinking, you are in your head. Just be, just." It's something that comes from within. If you see, people try to do things, and in the act of trying to do it, they're not actually doing it. You know, I think in the Matrix movie, there's a point where during the fight sequence where the Morpheus character says to the other guy, "Stop trying to hit me and just hit me." If you try to do something, you never get to the point of doing it because you're always in a point of trying, and so getting into the heart is just. Getting into the heart. It's not intellectual. It's just a state of being. Making decisions on the basis of what do I feel is the right thing to do here? Never mind what my logical mind may tell me. What do I feel? And it's just like anything else. The more that you use that and you work from that level, the more powerful and sensitive it becomes. So it just becomes part of your life, like riding a bike. When you're making a decision on doing something, you just know the way to go. You don't have to think it. You know it. And this is the difference between the head, which thinks and intellectually works things out, always ever so clever, you know, and the heart that just knows. And it's a completely different state of being. And it happens if you start going from that point of intuition, it gets more and more powerful until it's just absolutely the way you operate all the time without any question.
Do you have a way, I didn't notice it on your website, to get in contact with you?
Yeah, there's on the website, there's an email address. It's called David Icke Talks. That goes straight through to my wife, Pam, and so that's the way.
Good. Maybe we can get you up this way and you can start the revolution.
All right. I ain't going to start anything. It's people are going to start it by changing their reality. You know, I'm not the cavalry coming over the horizon. I'm not the guy sitting cross-legged on the mountain saying, "I have arrived. I'm here. I am come to save you." You know, it's about people taking their power back and not needing anyone to start
a
revolution because they are starting their own. The inner revolution becomes the outer revolution because the outer is simply a mirror of the inner. Changing ourselves, we change the world. This is why people say we must fight for peace. What are you going to fight for peace for?
We've got more fighting. Peace for peace, right?
Peace for peace. Peace within is peace without.
Well, you ever noticed these peace demonstrations this last week have gotten violent everywhere?
Yeah, well, this
it's
is...
almost
this
like
is,
agents
this is,
provocateurs of co-opting.
This is what I was talking about earlier, about polarity. If you meet violence with violence, you're creating two parallel polarities of violence that just create twice the violence and actually increase the likelihood of more violence breaking out because the reality consensus reality becomes more and more violent. And therefore, we need to peace for peace. You know, fight for peace? I mean, what a contradiction in terms. But the real revolution is it needs to go on within our own reality. If we live peacefully, then we will experience peace without. If we have conflict within, we'll have conflict without. See, one of the things that goes on within people, and we all do it, certainly, you know, I could do this for the world, really, because, you know, I'm not some enlightened cross-legged guy sitting on a mountain in all knowingness. You know, I'm fighting, wrong word, I'm trying to get through the fog of this illusion also, like everybody else. But if we have all this conflict within us, which we do, conflict between the head and the heart, conflict between how guilty we feel and all this stuff, all this conflict that goes on within us, this emotional turmoil that people go through, that must reflect out in the world we experience. Conflict within becomes conflict without. If we can find peace within, then there must be peace without, because the world that we think we experience, this holographic illusion, is a mirror of what's going on inside us all.
Is there any historical examples of not just groups, but I'm thinking of more societies or cultures that actually practice it and survive more than a few weeks? Because it always seems the barbarians always come over the gates of the civilization.
Yeah, but it depends on the reality of the civilization. If the reality is that I'm going to be peaceful, but because I'm going to be peaceful, it means that I am now in a situation of weakness and someone can come and do this to me, then once you let that reality in, then it can manifest. If it can't, it won't. It's like the placebo reverse. If you believe you're taking a chemotherapy drug, then people's hair drops out. They create that reality. So if they allow possibility, yes, because I'm being peaceful, I'm opening myself to these people coming and crushing me and all that stuff, then it can manifest. If it's not reality that can happen. Like I say, it's absolutely not in my reality that I can be stopped. I can only stop myself. I can't be stopped.
But it
because
seems
I'm
that
not
all the
allowing
high civilizations
my,
we've had have
my
always
reality,
been conquered
that possibility.
By, you know,
I cannot
violence.
Manifest it in my experience.
But has anybody actually not manifested and actually survived more than a few years?
I don't know. I mean, I can't think of examples. I have no idea. But in that Matrix movie, because there's so many great lines in it, the Neo character says to the Morpheus character, so are you saying that I'll be able to dodge bullets? And the Morpheus character says, no, I'm saying that when you're ready, you won't have to. And this is the thing. When we take control of our reality, we don't have to dodge bullets, because there's no bullets in our reality to dodge. That's taking real power back. And that's the level that I'm talking about. Changing our reality means changing what we experience. And if it's not our reality that we dodge bullets, there'll be no bullets to dodge because we won't manifest them. It's all an illusion.
And the
manipulation of the illusion is absolutely the foundation of the manipulation of the human race.
I'm dimly getting the idea that we're supposedly responsible now for our situation.
We're all absolutely responsible for it. Who's responsible for the guy's hair falling out when he's taking a sugar pill? He is, because he's manifested that reality by taking on the belief that his hair's going to fall out because he's actually taking chemotherapy. That is a wonderful example of how we are completely responsible for our reality.
So we're responsible for the Iraqi war.
Absolutely we are. Those that have the reality that is the way to do it and those things happen, yes, absolutely we're helping to manifest them. But we can demanifest them. See, what it is, it's this consensus reality. This collective unconscious, where we unconsciously have this consensus reality that we call the world we live in, the Matrix. And if we don't disconnect ourselves from that, and its assumptions, and its so-called laws, and its ways of doing things, then we're going to continue adding our power to it, and it's going to manifest as things like wars and conflict and all that stuff.
In sociology in college, they teach that if you want to have a massive change or a revolution in a society, you only need to have an active group of about 5%. And that seems to toe in line well with, like, say, the Civil War or the American Revolution. But if you can get an active 5%, you can drag that society kicking and screaming to whatever you want, communism or radical Muslimism, you know, whatever
Does
that apply also to what you're talking about?
This is an interesting point in relation to some of the things I've been saying tonight. Because it's also known as the 100th monkey syndrome. And because they found that when a certain number of monkeys or a certain number of a species is taught something new, suddenly, spontaneously, other members of that species that have had no access to being taught or shown it suddenly do it spontaneously. They know how to do it without being shown. And this is the collective unconscious. This is the consensus reality. What happens is that those that are shown, if you like, symbolically, the trailblazers, they, by gleaning that knowledge, put it into the collective level, the collective unconscious. And once it's there, it can be accessed by anyone who is connected to that collective unconscious. So suddenly, others that haven't been shown spontaneously somehow know how to do it. How do they know how to do it? They're accessing the collective unconscious that now holds that information. Now, the reason that what I was talking about earlier was that this illusion is basically a vibrational field oscillating to a certain frequency and pattern. And what needs to happen is that this vibrational frequency needs to be changed so it manifests a different reality. And what you're talking about is precisely what I was saying earlier. The more people who change their own reality, disconnect from the consensus reality, they start to beat a different drum, a different vibration, and they start to change the vibrational field of the consensus reality. And it doesn't take anything like half the population to do it. It's like you say, a relatively small percentage of people need to change the consensus reality that is the world that we think is real. And therefore it changes in the same way that the monkeys and the species change consensus reality, and therefore other people suddenly can do things that they couldn't do before without being shown. Why? Because they have the consensus reality has changed, so do they. And this is the process we're in. So everyone, people say, well, what can I do, mate? I've got no power. You change yourself. Change your reality. You change the world.
That's
the way it's happening. Because this is an illusion of mind, it takes a change of mind, reality, to change it.
In physics, that change of that vibration, if you want to change it, it's called resonance. As a
resonance,
soccer player,
yeah.
You know how that just a few people, when they start banging on the bleachers or the in a soccer game, can start the whole building to start swaying, if it's just a minority, as long as they're doing it in unison.
Yeah, well, all these examples you're giving are wonderful examples of what I'm talking about, and no better than a drum. Once we start beating to a different drum, we reach what is known as critical mass, which is, you point out, is nothing like the majority, and you start changing the rhythm, and when you change the rhythm, you change the reality.
This is what we're doing,
and it's happening. You know, I as I've gone around the world and more than 40 countries researching this and stuff. When I started out doing this, a man and a dog would turn up when the dog fancied it. You know what I mean? No one wanted to know. I spoke in Chicago once to 8 people. You know, and there's a lot of people in Chicago. And now it's changed dramatically. Why? Because this reality change is happening. It's a great time to be alive in this five-sense world, because we are going to see the change. In fact, we're experiencing it now, and it's going to just gather and gather and gather. You know, we appear to see those in control getting more and more power and getting more and more insane. But what we're actually seeing is the death throes of the old illusion, and it's being replaced by another one, and the prison is on its way to becoming the paradise. The only difference between a prison and a paradise is our reality. We want a paradise? Okay, let's have a paradise. The reason we don't is we get pulled into this this reality that, oh, no, mate, you're talking about utopia. You can't have utopia. Well, no, you can't if you don't believe you can. You know, oh, life's hard, mate. Yeah, it is if you believe it is. Whatever you believe is what you will manifest. We change what we believe. We change our reality. We change the world.
If
the world is our reality.
If you're in Africa, you know, primordial Africa, you only worked approximately 10 to 20 hours a week.
Yeah, you've got to work, mate.
50,
see, there was a thing that
it's
came out.
It's how culture gets created with that extra time. you have no culture because you
have
no
extra time. It was a document that came to light called Quiet Weapons Silent Weapons for a Quiet War. And it was a document detailing for potential agents of this Illuminati on how you control the population without the population realizing it. And one of the things in it was keep the people.
You have 1 minute remaining.
On with the other animals.
All right, I got one minute to get you off. Caller, I got to run. Thanks.
Brilliant, David. We got to get you into more areas in New York. I'll be sending you an email for some invites.
Well, as you can gather, I've got a genetic disease called verbal diarrhea. So,
well, I've got some kaopectate. Not a problem.
All right. Good night.
Night now.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Okay, David. I'm gonna call you back for like another, you know, for the remaining 10 minutes because I got like 30 seconds or whatever it is. So I'm gonna take a break. I'm gonna call you right back. I'm gonna continue and then we're gonna get you out. Okay.
Okay.
And then you'll be out the door.
All right, mate.
All right. You've been listening to David Icke tonight on the Lou Gentile Show, and you can check out his website at davidicke.com. That's davidicke.com. We're going to take a short break, get him back on the line. He's going to be here for about another 10 minutes, and then we're out of here. So you've been listening to the Lou Gentile Show. Don't forget, show is sponsored by International Broadcasting Corporation, ticker symbol IBCS. Stock is moving right along, up and out. Get in now or forever hold your peace. And also the phone lines are, excuse me, ticker symbol is IBCS. That's IBCS. Check them out on the web, ibcmedia.com. And the phone lines are sponsored by Northstar-Technologies.com. Check them out, 3.9 cents per minute. Can't go wrong.